Welcome to episode 172 of Speaking of Mysteries. Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. Today we're talking to Hallie Efron, whose Careful What You Wish For has just been published. So welcome, Hallie.
Thank you.
In Careful What You Wish For, I'm curious, how did you cultivate a sinister underbelly for something as seemingly benign as organizing? So in other words, where did the idea for this book come from?
You know, the germ of the idea is really one that I started writing about when I first started writing, which was about 30 years ago. So long before Marie Kondo came along and had us folding everything. I was married to a man who loved yard sales, who loved to bring things home. And when I didn't want them in the house, he would put them in the basement or the garage or the attic. And those spaces have gradually filled up along with the trunk of his car. And so it's the idea of being married to somebody or in a relationship with someone who has a different relationship with their stuff than you do, and what kinds of friction that raises. It's been percolating for a really long time.
You mentioned this, and you anticipate my next question, which is, you know, having asked the question about where the idea came from, differing attitudes towards stuff and territory, especially between a couple, could evolve into a motive for murder, I guess.
Yeah, you do want to kill him. When he won't get rid of his stuff. I mean, it's frustrating to be somebody who's always putting out stuff for Goodwill and churning through your closet and keeping open shelving on the, you know, and then having somebody who doesn't have a filing system but a piling system, and the piles are all over the house, and it can really wear on you. And I guess I'm in real life. My husband is a doll, and he's worth every aggravation he gives me. But I can imagine being married to somebody who would not be that way. And I can see it from both sides. I can see it from the side of the person who likes things orderly, and I can see it from the person who says, just leave me alone. I can find everything. This is no big deal. So what if I like this stuff? What's the skin off your nose? And then people who try to control each other through stuff is a more toxic kind of thing. And then people who have no control over, who can't throw anything away. That's a whole other kind of toxic mental illness almost at the other end of the spectrum. So I just liked all of those different permutations and how they affect a relationship.
And, you know, to be fair, the current Marie Kondoization is enough to make a collector, I'm using a kind word, homicidal towards the perpetual folder. You're in the beginning of the book, Emily, your protagonist, is, you know, quelling over her socks.
Yeah.
And the folding thereof. And it's you know, it's... It makes me want to tear my hair out.
Yeah, and she says she wasn't sure her sock drawer sparked joy. And she looks at it after she's done it. She has perspective, I think, on it. But her husband is so far the other way that.
Well, she has perspective on it, but she's also. I don't know exactly what age she is, but she's someone who's comfortable with social media. She does, I think for Instagram, she does little stop time videos of the evolution of an organizational project using her own closet or drawers. And so I found that, you know, a sort of a wonderful touch.
Yeah, she has a company called Freeze Frame Clutter Kickers, and she started it by when she sorted her sock drawer and took photographs along the way and then put them together into a little kind of herky-jerky animated thing where the socks saluted the camera and some of them disappeared and some of them scooted back in the drawer, and that's how she started her business. And then I think in the process, my thought was she would realize that it would be easier for people who have trouble getting rid of their things if they have a digital record of the thing that they got rid of. It's not gone. So that was the idea of it. And then the video stuff is fun to write, fun to imagine.
Yeah, and also visual, because I think it's just kind of from my perspective, an evolution of the form of writing, that things, you know, movies and television are so much part of our absorption of content. That word just makes me cringe, but content, that writers are just by their nature of their craft becoming more visual, describing not so much inner dialogues as what's happening through their characters' eyeballs, you know, what their characters are seeing.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that, because when I teach writing, and I teach writing at writing conferences, that's where I am right now, is at a writing conference in Portland, Oregon, the Willamette Writers, and I talk about the narrator having a camera in their head, and that's exactly what I say, a camera, and that you, as the writer, are inside that camera and see what they see, feel what they feel, and you're conveying that visually, almost stepping through the scene with them, and that's definitely cinematic. You know, that's from our watching so much television and movies, but it's also effective storytelling. Is the reader wants to be somewhere in the story. The idea of an outside of the frame narrator telling you what happens and narrating it is very old fashioned. It feels like, you know, Jane Austen. It's much more current, and I hadn't thought about it being related to all the movies, but of course it is. It's related to how visual our consumption of content, as you say, is.
And I can attest to your skill as an instructor. I have taken courses from you at two writers' conferences.
Oh, thank you.
They are stellar.
Thank you.
So, back to your book. In Careful What You Wish For, I found it a push-pull between the accommodation of Emily Harlow. She sort of goes along to get along, and those who would take advantage of her eagerness to please. And so could this be a passive-aggressive murder mystery?
Huh. I hadn't thought about that. If you have a small business and you have clients, and I have had for many years, I had a freelance writing business, so I know that process of meeting with somebody and scoping out the work and trying to figure out what is their vision of done for whatever the project is, and then mesh your own capabilities and time frame and how much energy you have and how much you think they really know what they want versus the person who's going to be a real pain, you know, the sliding goalposts. No matter what you do, it's still not going to be enough. So I'm very familiar with that kind of relationship, and she's in that relationship with her clients, but to some extent she's also in her marriage.
That's what made me think of it, that she seems to accommodate this husband that is, aside from his collecting, kind of a pill.
Yes, he is. He is. And yet, you know, well, he's an attorney. Not that that explains anything. I like
that. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
But he's very self-centered, let's put it that way. He is focused on his needs and wants and not so much his wife's. And part of their relationship has been soured by the fact that they've been trying to have a child, and they're not, they're, you know, whatever they're not compatible in terms of being able to create a fertile egg and for her to get pregnant, and that has been a strain on the marriage. So that is also going on for him and for her.
It's a bit of a toxic brew, but at the same time, you also have an ability, first of all, to do things like make organizing Sinister. That's number one. I was just so thrilled. But you're very sly in your writing, whereas this could be quite tragic and you know, just hung with crepe and gloom and doom. It's actually kind of funny and in parts. There's just
I'm so glad you said that. That's what I'm shooting for, is really a kind of slightly tongue-in-cheek.
And that's, you have accomplished it, at least in my humble opinion.
Good, good. Yeah, no, I'm not a big, you know, I don't write scary. I don't write violent. I don't even write a lot of sex, or really any sex. So I have to make up for it by entertaining the reader. And so I have to get you to like that main character and give her enough of an edge, a kind of humorous edge where she's not taking herself that seriously. And you can really root for her because she's, you know, she's lumping along. She's doing the best she can. And she's sort of fun. So I'm trying to remember this. She's the only narrator in the book, so you're very anchored to her, and her gradual awareness that things might not be the way they seem.
And in spite of this sort of initial presentation of a little bit milquetoasty, she finds these hidden reserves that surprise even herself. She's a very, Emily is a very likable character, I found.
Good. I'm glad. Because I wasn't wanting to write a kind of, there's so many lethal, unreliable female narrators out there right now in books. And I love reading them. I mean, you know, but I didn't want to write something like that. I wanted to write something a little bit more on the traditional side where there was a main character that you could really root for in an unconflicted way, and she was doing the best she could, and not withholding information, not being an asshole herself.
The next question is a little bit about craft. You know, obviously, when we talk about mysteries, one of the challenges in talking to writers is to not introduce spoilers. But in this book, and especially in the relationship between Emily and her husband, there are a lot of scenes where one character is causing the other to doubt what he or she heard or saw, and, you know, gaslighting, in other words.
Gaslighting, yeah.
And this must need a judicious hand to keep the reader guessing, you know, to sort of weave this sort of veil of doubt without either A, being heavy-handed, or B, kind of giving it away. And so is that something you approach in a different way when you're writing those scenes?
Well, it takes a lot of rewriting to achieve that. It is often the first time through when I write it, I don't even realize who's lying. I don't even realize who's gaslighting whom. And sometimes I'll write it, and it just seems too pat. It seems too obvious to me. So then I go back, and I think, well, where is this character coming from, and where is that character coming from, and how might they? What are they trying to achieve in this conversation? What are their conflicting goals, and how might they? How could I make it different so it's more surprising later when the truth is revealed? So it doesn't come out that way the first time. There's a lot of work that goes into shading and changing and sometimes completely reversing the dynamic of a conversation to achieve what will serve the book. And sometimes I don't know where the book is going until I've gone there, and then I have to go back and fix the steps up to it. I know everyone thinks, well, oh, my goodness, it's like a big puzzle. You must just lay it all out with index cards. And the truth is, I kind of figure it out as I go, and then sometimes I have to go back and make it all work together.
I know. That's part of the two schools and the inevitable question at every book signing, and one that I studiously avoid because it's mm-hmm. a bit in the weeds and a little about, how does your brain work? It's not... at least for me, and since this is my podcast, and I can be I can be a
say
little bit self-absorbed. it's such a personal, functional, you know, how does your heart beat? How does your brain work? What's your circulatory system? How do you plot a novel? And there are just two schools and variations thereof. And, you know, I'm a little obsessed on how writers name characters, because Cara Black named a character after me. So, you know, which was a wonderful thing in Murder in Bel-Air, and so surprising and so moving in many ways. So anyway.
And isn't Amy LeDuc a great character name?
Amazing. Amazing. And we talked about that. Yeah. I interviewed her and we talked about that, how she came up with the name. And I think that's a far more interesting question to ask writers, you know, and by all means, jump in if you want to talk about how you named Emily and Becca specifically, because they're such, to me, they're names of what I consider that generation, sort of 30-something, where there were a lot of Emilys. My daughter is that age, so a lot of Emilys and a lot of Rebeccas.
Yeah, well, my daughter's that age, too, and her friend growing up in high school was Becca. Not, her name was Rebecca, but everyone called her Becca. And there was Lizzie, and there, you know, all the names of that generation. It's like in my generation, it's Susan, Carol, Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
So when you name a character, I always like to use, there's a Google Names app where you can pick a year of birth and see what names were most common. And then you have a choice. Do you want your character to have one of the common names? And then look at the names that are there and see, you know, which one feels like it fits. Or do you want a character to have a name that was so old-fashioned that they hated it? And that gives you a different family dynamic. You know, if I'd been named Rose or Ida, I would have shot myself, you know. Hallie when I was growing up. Well, in our generation, you know what the most common name was for decades was Mary. And now it's completely off the list, completely off the list. It's way, 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 way down, like in the 1%. And yet there it was, just number one, number, like John is still number one. Don't know why that is, but it is, you know, for boys.
Back to the book. thank you for sharing that, though, because as I said, that's sort of my hobby horse now of how writers name characters. And it's fascinating because you really are conjuring, when you write a character, you are conjuring a human being in your mind, and a name is a very important part of that.
Yeah, the problem with writing is that you often have to name the character before you know them. So I do a lot of search and replace. You know, I'll get halfway through the book and realize my Susanna, it doesn't feel like a Susanna on page 120. She now feels like an Olivia, you know. That's a big difference. So I have to go back in and, which is why I never give a character a three-letter name. I have a rule. Because if you
it'll be part of a word.
It's, yes, you keep change entire words into gobbledygook.
When I asked Olin Steinhauer about naming characters, he said he just puts in bracket name one, name two, name three for characters and then names at the end. Once again, part of a methodology of writing and how people do things. It's different for everyone.
Yeah. Oh, that would make me crazy.
And when I asked Naomi Hirahara, she said she names characters for people, and that even for her villains, it has to be people she likes, because she doesn't want to have negativity in her book. So it's as personal as Outline or Pantser, only to me more interesting.
Yeah, I agree.
Emily and her organizing partner Becca, they have one client. In particular, and the pair becomes suspicious of the provenance of the items they are asked to organize. And the discovery of the books and illustrations in the storage unit reminded me of one of my favorite books, The Island of Lost Maps, a true story of cartographic crimes by Miles Harvey. And so I had to wonder if that was one of the inspirations, one of the sources you used.
Was that written about the same thing as The Map Thief?
Yes, that is The Map Thief.
That is The Map Thief. Okay, yes. My book is definitely inspired by that case, not by the book. I used the book as a reference when I was writing, but becoming interested in it has grown from seeing the newspaper stories about that guy, whose name I've forgotten, who was a trusted map dealer, mm-hmm. who would go into libraries and he would take these big atlases and take them into the back room where, you know, with his gloves and where you could look at the rare books, and he would slice maps out of the books and walk off with them. And just fascinated me because then who would know, you know, a big fat book with a page out of it, it would go right back on the shelf. And I think he was spotted eventually because he dropped his X-Acto knife on his way leaving a library. And it just fascinated me that someone who obviously loved maps, I mean, he was really devoted to them and such an expert, could get twisted in that way by money and finding, because maps are rare, you know, you can't just come up with them, and yet he managed to do that and sell them over and over again, and how long it took people to realize that. So I wanted to inspire it. I wasn't sure what the story was. I didn't want it to be that story, but I wanted to use all the techniques that he used. I just was fascinated by how he did it and the chutzpah, you know, with which he would, you know, make friends with librarians and
The region of the country in which the book takes place is also the location of many of these libraries that house these rare books, maps, in the case of these two characters, the wife, Murph, who wanders from library to library, you know, this sort of charming aging couple, you know, entering a library and looking at these books. Nothing could be more harmless.
Yeah, and you know, it's not even, well, let's not give it away, but, you know, she goes along.
Right, she's...
Anyway, it's a complicated relationship between the two of them, and that's what why I wanted to write about it, was because it's another iteration of the person who collects or the person who hoards is the person who covets, you know, who has this passion for something and is willing to be unscrupulous and talk themselves into it not being unscrupulous. You know, people manage to talk themselves into justifying things that obviously are not justifiable. And so I really wanted to get at that passion that people have for things and how it can warp you.
And of course that also extends to the woman who becomes Emily's nemesis. But my favorite character in the book was Lila.
Lila, everybody likes Lila. Yeah.
Emily's mother. Maybe it's because I'm a mother of about that age.
Yeah.
You know, that she's sort of, you know, a former librarian and kind of cutting loose now that she's in retirement. It also gives her an ability to talk to the book collecting, the woman in that couple, gives her an ability to speak to her directly. She was a great, almost Greek chorus-esque in,
mm-hmm, yeah,
in talking to...
Like Falstaff in Shakespeare.
Yes, like Falstaff in Shakespeare.
Yeah, she's a little comic relief, but she's also very smart. I like to write old women, and she's not that old.
Now, wait a minute.
That old to me. I mean, she's retired, and I don't like to caricature older women. So I'm hoping she comes across quirky and smart and not ridiculous, not like a clown. I don't want to write a clown. I want to write somebody who I don't know, you know, she's just smart. She's like, I don't know, Elaine May or something, you know, who's got a real edge to her and cuts through the nonsense and cuts right to the core, and who has a lot of experience that she's bringing to the table, both in terms of dealing with people and dealing with objects. She's got an expertise, but she's also got a wicked sense of humor. Yeah,
and I liked
style.
She has style, and what I liked about her is she is comfortable in her own skin.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is important.
Even though she's got orange hair and.
Which is important, you know. It's a great thing as you get older to sort of shed some of the things that you always thought you had to do and adopt other things if that's what you want.
If that's what you want, yeah. And she has a good relationship with her daughter. That's the other thing I wanted to write was a mother-daughter relationship. I have a really wonderful, I think, relationship with my kids. So I am sort of channeling that into her relationship with Emily. And Emily, you know, she finds her mother somewhat overbearing at times, and her husband, you know, poor Frank can't tolerate the mother. He wants her out of the house, but he does tolerate her. Anyway, I liked her a lot. She came out of nowhere. She's not based on anybody other than me, maybe.
Oh, well, smart, comfortable in her own skin, and with tons of expertise. Sounds like you to
a T. Sounds like somebody, yeah. She's got a good crap detector.
Good crap. What's next for Hallie Efron? Are we going to see a series with Emily and Lila and Becca organizing their way through crime to find solutions, sort of a twist on organized crime? Or... I know you usually write standalone, so that's my attempt of a joke.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because as I was finishing the book and I was writing that final scene, and I love the final scene in the book. It's
great
final scene. If you know my work, you'll see the Easter eggs in there.
Yep.
But I thought, you know, this could be a series. But I've already written my first five books were a series, and I just find that I'm still thinking about it, because I think it could be a partnership among Becca and Emily and Lila, the mother, and they could go on to have further adventures, and maybe Lila would have the next book and be the main character. Was how I was thinking if I was going to do that, but I haven't started anything. I've been really very much in a lull. I've been doing a lot of teaching and traveling. And I have another idea for a standalone that I'm kind of noodling around with, but I haven't actually written a page even. So this is the longest I've gone without writing. So I'm just not sure. Nancy, I don't know.
Well, I guess it'll give us something to think about and look forward
to. And certainly me.
And you as well. Yes, there were Easter eggs at the end of your book. For those who have read your books, there were Easter eggs. I appreciated that. And your fans will. But it might be nice to see one of these three women pop into your next book, maybe not as a central character, but they are unique and have an interesting view into human nature, I think.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about it. I'm actually thinking maybe I can take the idea that I had for a standalone and wed it to the one of these continuing characters.
Well, thank you again for joining us and talking to us about your new book, Careful What You Wish For.